Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies, both big picture, but also practical. I tell stories about things that work, but also my epic fails I've made along the way. And all because I believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And today we're going to be talking about this idea of how we approach AI through the lens of vintage innovation and what it means to do something called avoiding the Astrodome effect, which I'm going to get into in just a moment. But before we get there, I just want to say again, if you have not done so already, please check out boostpbl.com. That's where I have created, along with my collaborator, AJ Giuliani, a series of single day sprints, week long mini projects in full blown PBL units for grades K through 8. Again, you can find it at boostpbl.com. And then also, if you have not subscribed to my newsletter, check it out. If you go to spencereducation.com, you can find a spot where you can download the news or sign up, I should say, for the newsletter. And you'll get my updates in your email each week when I share a new podcast episode, article, or free resource. So check those things out. Without further ado, let's jump right in. The Astrodome was a modern miracle, a space age wonder with a glass dome, high-tech air conditioning, and the world's biggest scoreboard. When it opened in 1965, reporters dubbed it the eighth wonder of the world. This was the future. No more bad weather or quirky dimensions or any other pesky variables that made baseball messy and unpredictable. With the largest jumbotron in baseball and the trendiest color choice and a modern symmetrical design, this place embodied the space age. It was the anti-Fenway Park. This would be the ballpark of the future. Well, until the first game. Within minutes of the first pitch, people noticed a fatal flaw. A simple pop fly nearly blinded players. It turns out that it's hard to see a high-speed baseball when you're staring up at the glare of giant windows. Okay, simple solution. Just paint the glass ceiling tiles. But this, in turn, killed the grass because, well, it turns out you need photosynthesis if you're going to have grass. And you need to have light if you're going to have photosynthesis. And that led to the patented AstroTurf, which is, again, named after the Houston Astros and the Astrodome. This was a smooth, clean-looking, easy-to-manage artificial turf that added to the futuristic feel of the stadium. If you grew up in the 1980s like I did, you'll remember all of these places that had this, like, almost mint-colored carpet is what it looked like. Now, that was going to be the future, but this initial version of artificial turf, this early AstroTurf, actually led to career-ending injuries for the players. Now, if you're wondering what this has to do with AI and innovation, trust me, we're getting there in just a second, but more about the Astrodome. The bottom line was that the Astrodome wasn't designed for players. It was future-focused, not player-focused, or fan-focused, or even baseball-focused. And within two decades, this so-called eighth wonder of the world became a concrete relic of the false promise of futurism. The design team that had defined innovation as future-driven rather than purpose-driven. And in the process, they had created something flashy and novel rather than timeless and innovative. By the mid-1980s, nearly every Major League Baseball team had built their own massive modern stadium. These places were far too big. They were multi-purpose stadiums And they were a disaster for the game and for the fans, with bland aesthetics, horrible sight lines, and way too many seats. These concrete donuts were concrete disappointments. But then everything changed in the late 1980s with a bold new idea. Instead of just going forward, go backwards. Go vintage. Find inspiration in the ideas that had been abandoned in the Astrodome era. And so we ended up with Oriole Park in Camden Yards, or what we all like to call Camden Yards. This would be a quirky, creative, and connected to the community. It would be fan-focused rather than future-focused. When the team's owner pushed for a multi-purpose stadium, the team president, Larry Lucchino, pushed back saying, quote, let's look at the most successful baseball franchises out there. The Yankees in Yankee Stadium, the Cubs in Wrigley Field, the Red Sox in Fenway Park, and what do they have in common? They play in a baseball-only facility, a facility that was designed for baseball and did not compromise architecturally for other sports. This architectural team chose to look backward instead of just forward. Their vision was a so-called old-fashioned traditional ballpark with modern amenities. And so they borrowed ideas from Ebbets Field and Shy Park and the Polo Grounds and all these other ballparks that had been demolished and replaced with these god-awful concrete donuts. Instead of building with a clean slate at the edge of the suburbs, they designed the ballpark in the heart of the city. Rather than bulldozing the enormous B&O warehouse, they incorporated it into the design. And similarly, the oddly shaped plot of land contributed to quirky field dimensions and unique sight lines. In other words, they embraced the limitations and treated barriers as design features. In the end, they built this cozy ballpark with a view of the city skyline and an atmosphere that felt timeless. Decades later, Camden Yards has already lasted longer than the Astrodome. It's still relevant. And Camden Yards was a case of vintage innovation, incorporating old ideas and approaches into a new design in a way that proves timeless rather than novel. And I gotta tell you, there are other stadiums that have done this very well. It's not a matter of just trying to look like old and vintage. There are places that I would say have this very boring old aesthetic where it just doesn't fit and doesn't work. But then I'm thinking PNC Ballpark in Pittsburgh or Oracle Park in San Francisco or Petco Park in San Diego. They all have this vintage innovation thing where they really stand out as a unique place to watch a game. And that to me is what this is all about. I share this because I think this is an important thing to remember. We don't want to fall into the Astrodome effect when it comes to machine learning and artificial intelligence. And I actually fell into this Astrodome mindset one time when I was a middle school teacher. Here's what I mean. I get it. We live in an era of automation. Factories that once housed thousands of workers are now buzzing with rows of robots. And with artificial intelligence, the robots are learning to communicate, iterate, and improve in their performance. So what's happened? Many school leaders are responding to this reality by purchasing high-tech fabrication equipment, state-of-the-art makerspace, and of course, jumping full-fledged into AI and AI training. And here's the thing, that's not bad. None of those things are a negative. I actually lead a lot of AI training, and I think it's really important. And I have a course that's all about how to design a makerspace, and I love nerding out on high-tech equipment. So I totally get it, but in the rush to be high-tech, there's a danger in the Astrodome effect, where we embrace gadgetry and futurism only to find that the tools grow obsolete within a decade. While there's certainly a benefit from using the newest available technology, there's also a danger in abandoning all things analog. I learned this lesson the hard way in my third year of teaching. back in 2005, I know this was years ago, I decided to, quote, go paperless. I know, it's cringy. With my middle school social studies class, I spent the summer designing curriculum that would incorporate blogging, which was brand new at the time, podcasts, which really didn't exist in the way that we think of. You had to actually download them onto iPods. It was a mess. And shared documents, which at the time were called Writely, which later became Google Docs. I told you, this was years ago. No pen, no paper, no books, just computers zipping along on Linux. The school year launched with a rush of excitement. Students would show up before and after school. They rushed through the hallways to get to class early. And this was the future. I had nailed it, or so I thought. But then something happened. I noticed that my students weren't talking to each other before school. They were playing web-based games instead. And instead of creating content, they were watching videos. As the weeks wore on, the novelty wore off. The students no longer showed up early, eager to use the new devices. And then finally, a student pulled me aside and said, "Mr. Spencer, I missed last year." "What do you mean?" I asked defensively. "I missed the debates we used to have. I missed the Socratic seminars. Remember those?" I nodded. "Plus, some of this is boring. It took me 3 days to do a concept map, but last year we used Yarn to connect ideas back and forth. Remember that?" This student was right. We'd use different colored strings of yarn to connect concepts of World War I by wrapping them around meter sticks and discussing the connections between ideas. It had been frenetic and tactile and collaborative and, well, fun. And then I said, "But you can go back and look at the concept map you made anytime you want." "I guess so, but will I actually do that? I feel like I remembered it better when we used yarn," the student pointed out. "I hadn't thought about it," I admitted. "We had a paper fight for the Civil War, remember that?" "Remember that? How could I forget it? I had spent my entire prep period picking up paper balls. Of course I remembered that." And then he continued, "You let us sketch out our notes instead of having to type them. Could we swap with another classroom? Just for a day or two?" "You want to ditch the computers?" I asked. "Yeah, not forever, but just for a few days," he answered. And the student was right. In my rush to create a paperless classroom, I had fallen into the trap of techno-futurism. At that moment, I brought back the vintage tools and resources we had used before. We didn't abandon the computers. No, 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 no. We continued to do podcasts and documentaries and blogging. But we also used whiteboards and paper journals and sketchnotes. We swapped classrooms with other teachers so we could do physical simulations and games and they could use our computers. We had regular discussions and debates and Socratic seminars, but we also did analog and high-tech mashups like whiteboard videos and Socratic-style podcasts. We embraced that overlap of the tried and true and the never tried, of the lo-fi and the hi-fi, of the best practices and the next practices. We embraced vintage innovation. A decade later, when I had my own STEM and photojournalism makerspace, I deliberately chose to take a vintage innovation approach. This was over a decade ago. But I was already beginning to wonder about the dangers of excessive screen time. I could sense that some of the FOMO that I was beginning to see would later be, you know, explored in the future in something like the anxious generation, which is more recent, right? I could see that. I could watch kids getting more anxious as they spent more time on their devices. And so now fast forward to the present moment, and I can see why students are ready to embrace the tangible and the lo-fi. Students are ready to embrace the tangible. So we have a game room downstairs at my house, and I've noticed something fascinating. The most popular aspects of this space are elements that are tangible and interactive and even lo-fi and old school. One day, it's a group of college baseball players, my son included, shooting pool. Often, they meander toward the map of baseball stadiums, and they look at the pins that we've placed on all the MLB stadiums that we visited. This turns into impromptu storytelling, often with my son sharing some of the dumb things that his dad, me, has done on one of the trips, right? So I've done a lot of dumb things. Like, there's a lot of stories to tell. He's not going to run out. But on another day, it's the mock trial high school kids playing ping pong and throwing darts and often playing chess with one another. At one point, one girl even said, "I sometimes feel like mock trial is a cross between theater and chess, and I love that." I wish I had asked her what she meant by it, but I didn't want to interrupt her stream of consciousness. Or I think about my son who will organize a ping pong tournament, and I'll hear the ball bouncing back and forth incessantly, followed by cheers and gasps as I wash the dishes in the kitchen upstairs. Sometimes it's high school freshmen sitting around talking while they pet our two tiny dogs. Just kidding, they're giant Great Danes. Or they'll be perusing the bookshelves, asking who's read which graphic novel. Or my daughter might pull out the craft supplies from the cabinet and they'll color from the pages of adult coloring books or try to do a complex origami creation from this step-by-step instruction book from like the 1980s about origami. Or they'll just create their own craft out of nowhere. In every case, no matter what the crowd or what the age, they will all take their photos with the Polaroid camera, slap a magnet on the back of it, and place it on these metal sheets that we have hanging on the wall to be part of our picture wall. We might just need to buy a record player. I own both August and Everything After and Rumors on vinyl, and I swear that both albums are perfect from start to finish. Fortunately, the TikTok generation has somehow gotten really into Fleetwood Mac, but I doubt that they'll know anything about Counting Crows. Then again, who knows? I didn't think that JNCO jeans and double XL flannel shirts would get popular, but I'm seeing both of those things all over the place. Maybe Counting Crows will have a renaissance. Now, don't get me wrong. We have gaming consoles, and yes, they play games together too. But even then, it's social. It's hands-on. It's tangible. For all the talk of, quote, kids these days whose heads are stuck in their phones, I just haven't seen this in my own life. I see lots and lots of kids who seem to have this thirst for the tangible and the retro and the interactive and the social and the face-to-face. It's almost like coming out of the pandemic, many of them have said, yeah, I can inhabit a space of ones and zeros, but I want to have my feet firmly planted on the ground. I never want to take face-to-face interaction for granted again. In a world of mind-blowing compression where we can listen to nearly every artist on demand, I see a desire, no, a thirst for decompression, for slow, for tangible, for an album playing where you can't skip to the next song and there is no DJ X. I see it in the number of youth I see at musicals. My gosh, the number of kids in high school who showed up to cosplay for Wicked that we went to this last October. Or sporting events, or bookstores. Our local Barnes & Noble is so packed with Gen Z kids that I heard a woman say to her friend, "I haven't been to a Barnes & Noble in years. I don't know. I just didn't know that there'd be so many teenagers who loved to read. It makes my retired English teacher heart so happy." Her friend nodded and whispered, "Look, he's choosing Brave New World Remember when we did that dystopian novel unit with Maze Runner and Hunger Games? We can talk about AI. It's an amazing technological advancement. It really is. We can think about the future of virtual reality. It's going to be cool. But I also want to recognize that a generation of so-called digital natives are sometimes looking back at the old world and saying, what did we lose? And how do we recover that? So what does all of this mean in a world of generative AI? I want to share three main ideas to bring it home. Number one, we need a vintage innovation approach to AI detection. AJ Giuliani has a great blog post that offers the third way of AI detection. He describes the dangers of the lock it and block it approach of keeping generative AI completely outside the school setting. This includes strategies like in-class writing only, right? Blue books if you are in the higher education level. Lockdown browsers built on surveillance and plagiarism detectives. Or just using AI to do everything. But then he offers a third option. Here's how he describes it. It's basically an AI where students and teachers get a score about how human it is. So here are the steps. You or the learner enter the student's writing sample, then add the piece of writing you're checking. The Write Like a Human tool will see if it's human or AI. So normal AI detection software, right? There's tons out there. The student and teacher both then get to see the tool's feedback. This is not a gotcha moment. It shares areas that seem AI generated and reasons why. And that's the key piece right there. There's actual reasons why. It shares some suggestions and areas to make it sound more distinct and more human. This leads to a discussion, editing, revising, conferencing, allowing for multiple submissions. And then the teacher can even include a rubric or focus correction areas. Many options to choose from. Note that there is no gotcha in this process. It's a conversation. It is how writing like a human has been and should be in an era of technology. I love how this is focused on trust and transparency rather than algorithm-based surveillance. You can still use generative AI to check for plagiarism, but it's centered on the human element. And it's focused on what it means to be more individual, original, how to have your own unique voice. I've used this metaphor before, if you've listened to this podcast, of vanilla, right? And so it may very well be that something begins as being generative AI created, but students add their own unique flavor to the vanilla so that their voice stands out. And in a world of algorithms, that unique voice becomes critical. Number two, we need to embrace a vintage innovation approach to project-based learning. So earlier I mentioned Boost PBL. When we first created Boost PBL, we wanted it to be a little bit AI resistant. We wanted it to be old school. We wanted it to be hands-on and tactile. So we included ideas like sketchnote designs, ideation with sticky notes, whiteboards and markers. We offered suggestions for prototyping that used inexpensive and upcycled materials, but we also included opportunities for tech. We have slideshows that students can access. We are at the moment working on audio versions of our informational text as well. And now we are seeing improved AI tools, and so we're starting to add in the lesson plan some options of AI integration. And so what does that mean? It could be AI generating additional questions, clarifying misconceptions during research, using the chatbot as a Q&A tool to gain better conceptual understanding, restating research in simpler terms, navigating ideas, having sort of a thought partner as you judge your idea, generating project plans, so coming up with initial project plans. There's a lot of great tools that you can use for that. prototyping some ways where they could actually create some things using AI tools. So maybe they're building an app and they actually use AI to come up with some of the code. Coming up with group roles, project management, using it as a tool for project management to see if you're on track, getting feedback as you go. So notice all of these things are human-centered. They're initiated by the person, the human, but they're enhanced by the technology. And then finally, number three, we need to focus on collaborative personalized learning rather than just adaptive learning. And so what I mean by this is, I've shared this example before of the difference between what is personalized learning versus adaptive learning. And so personalized learning is all about collaboration, communication. It's things like choice menus and choice boards. It's interactive. But you as a teacher are going to use AI on the back end to create a lot of the resources, to come up with a lot of the ideas. By contrast, fully AI-centric models are adaptive learning models where students are essentially in front of a screen for hours on end, getting specific targeted feedback, specific targeted instruction. They consume it, they're tested on it, and they move up a level as well. So if you want to learn more about it, there's a video I have connected to this blog post. Just go to spencereducation.com. You'll find this particular blog post. You can see that video in it. Or just go to spencervideos.com and I have a whole sketch video sharing this difference between adaptive learning and personalized learning. But the goal is, if we want to take a vintage innovation approach, we need to embrace personalized learning more often than we embrace adaptive learning. So what does it mean for the future? This vintage innovation approach will often toggle between high tech and low tech, and that's okay. So it means that you might do a field trip or an outdoor school activity with device-free discussions, but then students podcast about what they learned. It might mean sketch notes for note-taking, but then a Q&A session with a chatbot. It might mean 10 minutes in front of an adaptive learning program to do some individualized skill practice, followed by a face-to-face Socratic seminar. Next week, I'm going to share four models about how we can approach AI integration in a way that's ethical and intentional. But I want to start with this recognition that a vintage innovation approach recognizes that being future ready doesn't mean you are only looking forward with the hopes of transforming education. It also means embracing the physical and tactile and getting excited about new tech. It means listening to some classic ideas and sticking to some of the best practices while also exploring the next practices. It's the recognition that in spaces that are often so polarized, we can be thoughtful and nuanced as we embrace a both and approach. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoyed this particular podcast episode, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, Amazon, wherever it is that you get your podcast? And also, if you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to this podcast and maybe tell a colleague about it. Word of mouth is still one of the best ways to share this podcast with others. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.